Please wave in the back if we've got the volume okay. One person waved, two are deaf. Okay, thank you. This really will be the time. I'm actually going to only speak for 35 minutes so we have enough time for questions, and because 5 minutes ago it was announced that the Prime Minister will be addressing the nation at 8:15 tonight with no warning. She's addressing the nation probably because she's taking a vote to the House of Commons tomorrow, because the European Commission have said she can have her delay if the MPs vote for her deal. But she may only give them a few hours to think about it. So it's going to be another fun 24 hours. How many of you are quite bored with Brexit? Can you give me an idea? Bored. Who's bored? Okay. Who still finds it exciting? Oh, we got a few dwindling. Okay. Let me try and make it a little bit more exciting for you. But I must admit, it has gone on and on and on. And nobody would have thought it had would have got to this point at all. 9 days to go. We have absolutely no idea what is going to happen. Most people in the country probably think it doesn't matter very much. It'll all be sorted out. It might well all be sorted out. The reason we know they don't think it matters very much is that the supermarkets still have toilet paper in them. There was a run on the supermarkets on the island of Jersey. It stopped, and people stopped panicking. We're a very, very pliant nation. I'm going to show you some graphs very quickly. Brexit is all about geography. Of course it is. It's all about borders. That's what the thing is. It's being run by the first Prime Minister ever to be a geography student, which is Mrs. May. The first image I've got for you is an image of migration, which again is all about geography. This is a graph. It's a graph which is showing the pattern from 1841 right through to the latest census, which is 2011. And what's being shown on the graph are the numbers of people who were born in another country other than the United Kingdom. And we've selected some particular areas out. You can see Ireland if you've got good eyesight at the beginning. And you'll see various times in which it rises faster than normal. It rises particularly quickly around about 1905, when we had what we thought at the time was large-scale Eastern European migration, particularly Jewish people coming. And we weren't very nice to them. We formed the British Union of Fascists. We introduced immigration acts. We produced lots of extremely anti-Semitic cartoons. And then we got a bit embarrassed. And then the Second World War happened and we got really, really embarrassed and tried to pretend we actually hadn't been really nasty. But then we needed some more people. So Enoch Powell, who was the Secretary of State for Health, went down to the Caribbean and he asked people if they'd come and be nurses, because we didn't have enough nurses in the NHS. And he asked people in the Indian subcontinent if they'd come and work the night shift in mills, because we didn't have enough people, because we hadn't had many babies in the 1930s, to work the night shift in mills. And we invited people to come. And the first large group came on a ship called the Windrush. And they came. And then we were a bit nasty to them. And we had racism, and people were stabbed. And in one case, two cases, three cases, a dozen cases, they were killed. And then we pretended that none of us actually were racist. And that wasn't us. And then the latest one is a little triangle. I'll try and highlight it. That's why I'm standing up here. I don't know if you can see it. That little triangle is the AA migration. Mainly Poland, about 1 million. We invited them. We opened up early to the Eastern European countries before the rest of Western Europe did. That's called an invitation. We invited them and we did very well. We got the most skilled, most get up and go, most energetic people from Eastern Europe to come. And what happens when they come after we invited them, after we did something we didn't have to do, after we opened up our borders early? We said, this is terrible. Look, there's 8 million people from abroad. It's too many. It's full. And if you look at the surveys in Brexit, the main thing you get when you look at the reasons that most people voted leave, not everybody, but most people, was twofold, no control of our borders, immigration. Look at it a different way. Put all the people born in Britain. And you look at it in a different way. And suddenly it's not so many. It's amazing how things can be different, just looked up in a different way. You may say, oh Danny, you've just done a trick there. You know, it's still quite a lot, it's 8 million. It doesn't feel the same as the country I grew up in. And I can talk to you, but I haven't got enough time, about what it feels like to have your city filled with immigrants. Because I grew up in the city of Oxford. And my city is filled up with immigrants. Most of them come from England, but they didn't come from Oxford. And you can't afford to live in the city of Oxford if you grew up in the city of Oxford. You may say, well, that's just London and Oxford. Well, I can tell you about parts of the country where the immigrants come in the largest group of immigrants, and they buy the nicest houses because they got more money, and they don't even learn the language. And that's the west of Wales, where the English go to retire. We can tell different stories about immigration. Let me just tell you one last story about immigration. And this is the European map. And it's a bit complicated. But this is about where has the most immigrants. Now the map is stretched because it's a cartogram, because we don't want you to look at places where there aren't people. So the large blobs you can see are London, Madrid and Paris. Scandinavia's mainly made small because there aren't many people. Greece is mainly Athens. How many of you have seen a cartogram before? Stretched map. So few. We got it in the GCSE 2 years ago. Need to try and do it again. Okay, the dark blue is where 1 in 5 or more of the population were born abroad, outside the UK. So who here was born abroad? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, about 2%, less than 1%. That's not odd, because most of you are very young. How many of you have got a parent who is born abroad? That's higher. Okay, we're looking at about between 5 and 10%. Okay, and you're typical of this area. If you look at the UK, most of the UK is yellow. All there? Yellow is less than 5%. Less than 1 in 20 people are born abroad. Most of the UK is low migration compared to the European norm. It is like Eastern Europe. Eastern Europe has only 1 in 20 people being migrants, usually coming from further east, from Russia. Most of the UK is low migration because there isn't that much to come for, and it's a little bit far to come because it's on the edge. If you look at northwestern Europe, Germany, Netherlands, France here, Switzerland, northern Italy, you'll see it's the kind of same colour as London. Because in the centre of Europe, it is very normal to be a migrant. You simply grow up on the Dutch border, you get a boyfriend or girlfriend 10 miles away in Germany, and you decide you want to live together, and one of you is an immigrant. That's one of the main ways in which it just happens. Switzerland is the blob in the middle with the highest immigration rate because it's a long, thin country with some mountains in the middle, so you're very near other countries in terms of most people. The other area on the map, which is a high immigration area, is the Spanish coast. And the group of people in the Spanish coast, the largest of the immigrant groups, are not immigrants, because we are never immigrants. They're expats. They're mainly old. Depending on what happens in the next 9 days, you'll see some of them. You'll only see the ones who are ill. Because the others, of course, are going to carry on. I mean, who would come back at this time of year to Britain? They'll only come back when they're ill, because they won't be able to use the Spanish health service in 9 days. The deal we have a financial deal at the moment where we actually pay less than we owe in, because Margaret Thatcher is good at negotiating. But the much more important unwritten deal we have is that we take 3 million largely young, largely fit, highly skilled people who we didn't pay for their birth, for their education, for their training, another country did that, We just take them in when they're young adults. We pay them really badly. We give them the jobs we don't want to do, and we house them in really bad housing, for which we charge them an enormous rent, so we can go on our cruise holidays. 3 million. And at the same time, we send out 1 million, like Nick Clegg's father or David Cameron's father, who spend their last few years sunning themselves in France or Malta or Greece or Spain before they die, not working and using their health services of another country. The amazing thing is that we're the first of the EU 28 countries to want to leave. It is stunning. We probably had by far the best deal. No other country had that demographic deal. So we didn't do the leaving based on the calculations of this will be good for us. We did it about something else. And what's hard to work out is what the something else might have been. This little graph here is of the votes going up and down. Because I'm determined not to run out of time, I won't go into detail other than to tell you there wasn't a settled view. Leave was very strong a few years after the financial crash. We blamed everything for years and years on immigration and the EU. So when things get worse after 2008, 2009, when it has to be the EU, it must be something about the shape of bananas, which is meaning that my kids can't afford a house, you know. And then people talked about it a bit more and it oscillated. Remain became very popular. David Cameron calls a referendum. David Cameron just loses the referendum. The numbers there are the proportions of the electorate. Geography. The most exciting geographical map of human geography you will ever see. I'm not getting any response from you on this, but it still makes me excited, and I've spent 2.5 years looking at this. The reason that map is exciting is it doesn't look like any other human geography map you will ever see. Most maps of the human geography of Britain look remarkably familiar. If it's a map of GCSE results, which areas do children do well in, which they do badly in, or a map of health, life expectancy, or map of how people vote, or map of poverty, or map of house prices, or map of everything I draw maps of, you get the same bloody pattern. But not with this. The correlation of deprivation with this was 0.03. That's nothing. This isn't a map about wealth or poverty. This is a very, very different map. It's a map which has got peculiarities in it. Scotland, the enemy was London, not Brussels. Scotland voted for Remain. Didn't have a problem with the EU, has a problem with London. Wales actually voted absolutely bang on the UK national average. So the interesting question with Wales is why do we keep on asking why they voted out when they actually voted out at the average rate? And if you were to take out those on average slightly right-wing Daily Mail, Western Mail Daily Press is called in Wales, reading English retirees, and not all like this, but on average, if you take them out, Wales becomes a Remain country. Northern Ireland, a Remain province. It's England, only England, which is Leave. And it's not all of England. Okay, London is a really obvious place that's Remain, and the places that have it too good, Oxford, Cambridge and so on, I'll point them out. Here's Oxford, there's Cambridge, there's London. We are down here in Leave country. As you didn't get a vote, I will not do a poll of who voted. What I can tell you is that if you had voted, you would lie. You would mean to lie, it would not be a lie because you wouldn't mean to do it. But if you ask people how they voted, 90% of them tell you they did. Because you reconstruct memories of this thing, which is why the data really matters. You cannot even rely on your own memory of what you did yourself. The rate at which we lie to ourselves about opinions and behaviours is quite incredible. If you ask the young how they vote, a majority will tell you they voted Leave. The very large majority did not vote. We can be pretty sure of that because we do know how many people voted and there wasn't any burning of ballot papers going on. I won't go on about the map other than to say the majority of the blue you can see is in the south of England. The media have largely got the story wrong about the geography of the vote. Under that line, or under that line, is the south. The majority of Leave areas, Leave votes, 52% was in the south. I think 59% ABC, one social class, majority UKIP, Tory former voters. Not the story the media managed to tell well, because they didn't expect to be telling the story at all. The young, here's the results by age. 18 to 24 year olds, 70% don't vote. They're in bed. They have been in bed since 1992. That's when young people stopped voting. It was a year after we introduced something called the poll tax, which is a tax just for being alive. And it was an amazing incentive for young people not to register to vote, because they didn't have to pay the poll tax if they didn't register to vote, so they didn't. And they began to forget how to vote. The good news about Brexit, and there is loads and loads of good news, and I've just got 15 minutes left to keep to my timetable. The good news is, it finally has jolted young people to vote again. They voted like anything in the 2017 general election. So young people are out of bed again, having been in bed for something like 26 years. And that's just one of the many really, really interesting things that's happening. Older age groups, I'm here, I'm in the middle of the 45 to 54 year olds. Sadly, I'm nearer to 54. My age group, we're leavers. We're leavers. Majority of us. Oh, and we vote. And that really matters. Oh, and there's a lot of us. Because I was born in the 1960s, when people had more than two babies each. So we vote, there's lots of us, and we vote leave. We probably vote leave for you. It's not about selfishness. Tinge of racism and bigotry, but really, it's why can't your grandchildren get a house? Why can't they get a job which will pay them enough money to be able to get a house? Why can't they start a family? Why is it so hard to use the health service? And then you get the rumours, oh, it's other people using the health service, it's other people buying the houses, it's other people putting the jobs down. If you wanted the same level of health service that they have in Germany, there's a really, really easy way to get it. You pay for it. The difference is that the Germans spend an extra 1,050,000,000, 1,050 euros every week on their health service. Forget 350 million on the side of a bus. That's the amount of money you need to get a German level of care. But you might want the French level of care, which is even better. But they spend more. That's the reason why the health service doesn't work. It's not that hard, it's a lack of money. We're very lucky. A third of the midwives in London are EU but not UK citizens. We're exciting, interesting. We were thought of as multicultural. People came to work for really low wages in areas where the wage wouldn't even pay their rent and deliver our babies. The radiologists, the anaesthetologists, the surgeons, there's always somebody who's not a British citizen, which is going to make it rather difficult if we don't get it right in the next 9 days. Which is why she's going to be talking to the nation at 8:15 tonight. Last bit of geography for you. And this is about the press getting it wrong. The press got it wrong because they had a particular story to tell. When the referendum happened, the unexpected happened. And Sunderland was first to declare. And so the story came, oh, it's poor people in the north who are upset and angry. The only problem was it wasn't true. People in the north are much more likely, like the young, just not to vote. So who voted Leave? And what I've done here, I've got three examples. I'll only read one out to you. If you're very fast at reading and got very good eyesight, you can read the Essex one, but it goes on and on and on. I shall read you the last one. I'll read you Hampshire. So Hampshire, the county of Hampshire. I should have picked Dorset, shouldn't I? Dorset's even better. Anyway, Hampshire. More people voted Leave in Hampshire, despite Hampshire having a smaller electorate than the combined electorate of Bolsover, Doncaster, Hull, Chesterfield, Salford, Stoke-on-Trent and Sunderland. So I've created an area to compare Hampshire to, and I'm telling you more people voted Leave in Hampshire than those areas combined. Those areas combined had a bigger electorate. They had more people who could have voted, less people voted. Hampshire provides more Leave voters. The Prime Minister shouldn't have gone to Stoke, she should have gone to Hampshire. The right bit of Hampshire, yes, but she could have found a bit of Hampshire which is voting out more than any of those other places which are typified. Why? Because most of the old of Britain live in the south of England. And most of the middle class live in the south of England, and the old and the middle class religiously go and vote. But they also wanted to leave. These are the kinds of things we're discovering about ourselves. We're shocked by Brexit, but also discovering we can't even explain Brexit. Our press is even completely incapable of describing the simple geography that's not a matter of opinion. It's not a result of a survey. You've only got to add up the votes. The votes are a matter of public record. We know for every area exactly how many people voted which way or didn't vote. What I'll tell you about Social Class ABC1 comes from a large survey organised by Lord Ashcroft called an exit poll, and it has a margin of error around it. But what I tell you about the geography of the vote just is. So why have our media not managed to tell the story that this is a majority South England Leave vote? We're an odd country. Remember, the question is, why are we all the EU28 us? When something happens with 28 countries, it is normally a small one that does the odd thing. The large countries, in this case Italy, France, Spain, Germany and us, tend to never be at the extremes, normally. Just by chance, it would be hard to get. The only place to have left the European community, not the EU because it didn't exist, was Greenland. Greenland spent 3 years negotiating because they had 56,000 people and it's complicated. The negotiations with Greenland went well because they had something to negotiate with. And this is really interesting because I'll end talking about the negotiations with Britain. The thing they had to negotiate with, and it came up very strongly what Klaus was saying, was fish. Because the mackerel had moved up, and the cod and the herring were there. And they had the fishing rights. And in return for the fishing rights, we still send €500 per child to Greenland to help pay for their education system. There aren't many children, so it's not that much. But they also have the right, as Danish citizens that they've kept, to come and work and live in the European community if they get a bit bored of Greenland, which, you know, you could do because it is a bit cold despite all the beauty. That is what a deal looks like. It is perfectly possible to negotiate a deal. Greenland negotiated a deal. But we're different. We are extreme in a number of ways in the EU28. We have, by far, the highest income inequality. We were the second most equal country to Sweden in the 1970s, so something weird happened. The top 10% of people in this country take 40% of all income. I'm one of them. If you imagine we were to line you all up by whatever kind of allowance your parents give you to buy clothes, and then we take the tenth of you who get the most, and you can have, say, £40 a week to get clothes, and everybody else gets... what's left between them? They get £60 divided by 90. That's like 70p each. Or something like that. 40. It's fine if you can do it with pocket money, you'd never agree to it. The best off 10th get 40%. The other 90% of people in Britain get 60% of GDP to live on. That's our inequality. But why did we become that unequal? Now the map I've put up there is a map of the British Empire. We tend not to teach this, so I'll do it very, very quickly. Those are all the countries which we walked into uninvited. They weren't countries when we walked into them uninvited in most cases. We later made them a country. And the dates at the end are all the dates where they could manage to get rid of us. Although we don't tend to teach that. The first ones to get rid of us most effectively were the 13 colonies of North America. We burned their White House down, but still, they called us terrorists, we called them terrorists, and then they chucked us out. And the Americans became independent. We did incredible things. We weren't the only ones. Portugal and Brazil did this, but we picked up people from the coast of Africa. And we shipped them against their will to the Americas. We made them pick cotton in the southern states before they got their independence. We shipped that over to Manchester. We wove goods in Manchester. We shipped that to India. We made India stop making its own textiles so they'd buy our goods from our ships, which we built. And then when India couldn't make its own textiles, we told them to grow opium. And we shipped the opium to China, and we called it free trade. And when the Chinese said, we don't want the opium, we fired on them. And that's just a little bit of what we did. We had the largest, most successful empire the world has ever known, and we were the richest place on this planet about 130, 140 years ago. It's a long way down, particularly if you don't tell anybody the story. If you don't tell people, why did Shiraz close? Why aren't we very good at making cars? Why weren't we actually that good at making anything once we no longer control people that we could make them buy our stuff anymore? Why are we used to having riches beyond our own means? Why can't we share very well? Why do we have an education system which is so divided and hierarchical, unlike anywhere else in Europe? It's because of empire. It's a very good way to run an empire. It's just a problem. If you don't have an empire anymore, it's not that useful. The picture there is my favourite happy little example, as opposed to the sort of more depressing one about what we used to do. It's the picture of the daughter of the last governor of Hong Kong crying as the sun set on the British Empire as the last colony went. And any of you of my age or older, you remember the camera zooming in on her tears. Just to the side is Prince Charles looking a bit gormless, to be honest. He wasn't very good at dealing with women crying. And the story was she was so sad because Britain was losing control of Hong Kong and it was a great thing that we controlled Hong Kong. Nobody ever said that day why we controlled Hong Kong and how the exact date in which we took control of Hong Kong coincided with the first shipment of the drugs that we were peddling. She wasn't crying about Hong Kong. This is the good news. She wasn't crying at all about Hong Kong or the British Empire. Of course she wasn't. She was a teenage girl. She was the age of you in the audience. She cried for 3 hours that day. There is camera footage of the poor thing crying for 3 hours. She cried for the reason that any teenage girl would cry, and she's said so in the paper since. She cried because she had a really nice boyfriend and he was very good at surfing, and she was so happy she was with him, and she couldn't understand why her dad wouldn't just let her stay in Hong Kong. Right? That's the real story, and you can go through the British Empire. And I like to collect the happier ones. But we just tell ourselves lies. When I was at school, when I did history, I had to memorise how we invented the spinning jenny, Arkwright with this, some other mill, some other shuttlecock, all the rest of it. Because we taught children at my age that we were so rich because we'd invented everything in the world. Well, it's kind of a comfortable little myth. If you go over to the Industrial Museum in Paris, you can see who invented their spinning jennies and all the rest of it. People copy inventions from each other in all directions. But not everybody can control a fifth to a quarter of the planet. You can't all do that. We're odd. I think it's, is it this Saturday there's a protest in London? We'll see how big it is. I mean, the government have tried their best to get the excitement up. But we don't protest. You can see, if you can read the text there, the French are really, really good at protesting. How do you think they get more spent on their health service than almost anybody else in Europe? Yeah? It's not just wearing yellow jackets. That's the kind of fashion this year. They're generally good at protesting in France. They have the highest median family income. If you have a third child in France, the government gives you even more money for the third child than they gave you for the second one. If you have a third child in this country, you get nothing. And we don't protest, and the French, even though they're getting more money for the third kid than the second one, and loads of other benefits, they're out there burning Paris down, which is actually what you need to do if you want to keep your rights up. The Germans are about the most boring people in Europe, if you want to stereotype. But when it comes to demonstrations, we are twice as boring as the Germans. We just don't do it. And there has to be a reason why we don't protest. And it may be we feel we don't need to, after all. by not protesting, we did pretty well for a couple of hundred years. And then when the empire went for a short time, we kind of fixed it by reducing the rules on the banks so they could do almost anything they wanted after 1986, and that made some of us rich again until 2008. At some point, Britain is going to have to make things that people want to buy without them being forced to do it, or without running banks which are unregulated so they can make a profit but it's unsustainable. That's going to come. I'm going to zip forward if this thing will let me. I'm going to skip that, it just says we don't spend very much. And I'm going to skip to one last graph, which is not that one, and not that one, and not that one, it's going to be that one. Okay. Because this is all about what Mrs. May is going to be talking about in 30 minutes. A 585-page deal, which she will tell to the nation. I could get it wrong, we can put it on the screen after your questions and see, for those of you who don't have to get home. I think she's going to say, tomorrow I will bring the meaningful vote back to the House of Commons for a third time. The first time was on the 15th of January. But it is different this time. So the Speaker cannot stop it. She'll say it is different this time, even though it will look exactly the same. Because the difference will be that Donald Tusk has said that he will agree to a delay until around about the end of May, 23rd to 30th of May, give or take, but only if the House of Commons votes tomorrow to accept Theresa May's deal. Donald Tusk can't actually promise that because it requires the agreement of all 27 heads of state. We're remarkably, you know, optimistic that all 27 are going to do this. Anyway, she's going to tell people that that's what she's doing tomorrow. And then MPs will be asked, at very short notice, to vote in the opposite way to which 400 of them voted on the 15th of January, the biggest defeat that any government in this country has ever suffered. So the question is, with 4 minutes ago, why do they hate the 585-page deal so much? And the reason they hate it is there's almost nothing in it apart from giving up. It basically says, we will leave. There will be a transition period during which most of the negotiations will happen, but we won't have a chance of going back then, we will have left. The European Union will protect Northern Ireland. That's the way I would put it, because what I didn't talk to you earlier is you may have spotted high immigration rates in Ireland. Ireland is like normal Western Europe. There are lots of immigrants. They happen to be people born in the north who live in the south, and people born in the Republic who live in the north. That's why there is no border and has been no border since the Good Friday Agreement. The deal is almost no deal. There's almost nothing there. It's a deal to commit to having a deal, despite the fact of being 585 pages. On things that really matter, it only contains 115 words. 115 words on the entire finance industry. You need a delay, because you have to quickly come to a deal about the banks before the 23rd of May or whenever, because otherwise they can't operate in the mainland, and then you're in trouble. So why did we get such a bad deal? Why did we get the kind of deal that Greenland got? You know, where they can still go over there, their kids get a bit funded, all that kind of thing. This graph shows you why, I think. The graph was produced by Standard & Poor, and it was published, I think, about 2 or 3 weeks before the referendum. And it's a graph of which other countries in the European Union the Standard & Poor, these financial analysts, estimate will be most affected by Brexit. Now, the most affected country is Ireland. And that, in hindsight, is kind of obvious. But they thought Ireland would be detrimentally affected. As it is, Dublin has the most amazing boom going on right now. The cranes are all over Dublin. because Ireland will soon be the only English-speaking large country which is in the EU. So if you have to operate in the EU, as 5,000 bankers from Barclays are moving over, and countless others, and you want your children to grow up with learning English, that's where you've got to go. So Ireland's actually doing well, but it is the most affected. The next one is Malta. Malta is a small island which is not very important. The next most affected is Luxembourg. Luxembourg specialises in slightly dodgy tax arrangements. It is also small and it is not that important. The next one is Cyprus. Quite a lot of our retirees are out in Cyprus. But again, it is small and not that important. Then the next one most affected is Switzerland, which gets no vote because it's not in the EU. The next country most affected, as estimated by Standard & Poor's by Brexit, is Belgium, which is small, and Netherlands, which is pretty small, and Spain, which is only affected because it loses the pounds from these pensioners, but it doesn't have to look after their health, and they're getting older anyway. This is why she came back with such a bad deal. People often say that Germany sells 1 in 10 of their cars to us. It won't be in their interest not to get a deal. We've just shut the Honda plant at Swindon. The county car plant, 2 miles from my house, is bringing its summer closure early to the 29th of March, 9 days' time, for 3 weeks. It can either reopen in 3 weeks' time, or they can put the 1,200 robots that made the cars into the back of lorries and try to work out how to get them through Dover when everybody else is trying to get their robots out through Dover. Nissan ain't going to be operating if we don't have a deal up in Sunderland. We will still be buying a tenth of Germany's cars, or maybe 15%, given that we're stopping making them here. We're just going to buy the little ones, which will be really, really good for air quality. There are a ridiculous number of silver linings to Brexit. I don't want to get you scared about it. The biggest silver lining of the whole thing is it brings everything to a head. Had the vote gone the other way, 55% remain, even 60% remain. We now know, because Leave won, that the people who funded the Leave campaign were absolutely determined. We know what they wanted and why they wanted. We know they expected not to win, which is why Boris Johnson was so upset on the day after the vote. His plan was that Leave would just fail, he'd become Prime Minister, and so on. The alternative, I'm afraid, you faced a few years ago with a Remain victory was just a delay for a second referendum when the Leavers were to try to leave again. And on the way to trying to leave, the Leavers would have blamed everything on the immigrants, and the atmosphere would have got worse and worse. What's happened is that the vote to leave and the carrying it through has called the bluff of those who say that we are in such a strong negotiating position that we'll be better off out. It's called a bluff. There are still people who believe that. For them, and they're a dwindling number, you'd have to go the whole hog, crash out on the 29th of March. There'll still be some when you could kind of be floating on a desert island saying, look, this hasn't worked, and they'd be going, oh, you just didn't try hard enough, and you weren't patriotic enough. But most people are beginning to twig that we weren't in a good bargaining position, which is why we got such an awful deal, a deal which even a huge number of the government's own MPs will not vote for. The question is, and I haven't got the answer to this, you may ask me, so I'm going to stop now and think of a question. The question is, are our 650 members of parliament up in the next 9 days minus a weekend to actually demanding what most of them want to happen to happen? Or will, out of some almighty kind of mess, nobody get what they want, or almost nobody? The Remainers not get what they want, which is the delay of not leaving, may not get a deal, and we teeter along on the 28th or 29th at the end of next week, trying to work out what the implications are of leaving without a deal. And I can list those if you want. I won't do it now, other than say the Eurostar think they've got 6 weeks. And my book, my Easter holiday early, so I think I could be one of the last people to use Eurostar if we do crash out. Thank you for your patience. Please think of a question. Under May's deal, we have less sovereignty than we had before. In a sense, we're partly handing Ireland away, that's what the DUP has sort of said. But we won't know what we were negotiating. So I think May's deal actually reduces our sovereignty, what we have. We do have slightly diminished sovereignty, it's only slightly, partly because we actually introduce more of the rules that are annoying in Europe come from us than any other country, because we have a trait that means we really like rules and we like writing things on notices and sticking them up on walls. We're kind of into rules. So when you look at the European regulations, we've created more. What I think on silver linings, I mean, there are lots of problems with the EU. They take about 1% of our income and they're not very democratic. Although a first-past-the-post voting system isn't very democratic either. My hope is that us trying to leave, A, has shown how almost impossible it is for any other country with a substantial border to leave, which means that the EU27 have to realise they're stuck with the EU and they need to make it work. And making it work means making it democratic, means giving the Parliament more powers and not the dodgy commissioners, or a thing called a semester. If you really want to get into your EU, then what's wrong with the EU? There's a strange way in which some decisions are made. I think that will improve because of this. I personally am happy about what is going on. I think Brexit is like the Suez Crisis. It's a bit embarrassing, very embarrassing, but it's like pressing refresh on your computer. When you power everything down, all those programs that were slowing it down, and start again. And we kind of did that after Suez in the 1960s. I think we're going to do that after Brexit. So it's a rambling answer to your question. It's a very fair question. The European Union needs to become more democratic. However, it should also look at how it does that, because you don't want to be democratic the way the US did. The USA became democratic in a way that a minority of voters can actually elect Donald Trump because of the particular system they put in place. So I think you need to look carefully at what kind of Europe you want, where you really do have devolved power as far as you can devolve it, but at some point decision making made for a whole continent that is fair and is not being done behind closed doors. I promise the next answer will be much shorter.
Thank you. Just an extra thing on the sovereignty question. I mean, what a lot of people talked about in the campaign and everything is, you know, undemocratic EU and Brussels and so on. Perhaps slightly overlooking the fact that what they call Brussels is the Council of Ministers of the EU, which includes ministers from this country.
Yes.
In a situation where we've left and we no longer have representation in the decision-making process of the EU, we are still, whatever the actual scenario that happens, I submit we are going to be very heavily affected by what happens in the EU simply by the fact that they're next door, but without any say. I mean, would you say that is actually an improvement in our sovereignty position or perhaps the opposite? Sorry,
that's a
leading question.
That is leading. And some of our commissioners are the ones who argued most strongly with the Prime Minister's, various Prime Minister's backings, for the EU to relax, to firm up free market rules that mean you can't do things in your country. We were the leading country on that. it's kind of, we're squeezed between the United States and Europe. We are going to have to accept the rules of one or the other. It's either chlorinated chicken, or it's chicken which is labelled by its kind of bit of Provence it comes from, you know. We can try and go it alone, the Singapore of the West idea that some people have. Jacob Rees-Mogg's father, his last book, William Rees-Mogg, wrote a last book called Sovereign Wealth, which is this idea. That we kind of become a giant Guernsey and Jersey, an offshore banking trading island, obeying neither the rules of America or Europe. And somehow they let us take money from their industrialists, screw it away in Britain, not pay any tax on it. Now, my feeling is that I don't think the USA and Europe would let us do that. I know that the USA recently demanded to be able to see every single Swiss bank account, and the Swiss said yes. Just before the Swiss said yes, Americans moved their money out and they bought houses in London. So I don't think that idea will work, but I could be wrong. But I also think a Singapore of the West and a banking-free island wouldn't be a pleasant place for most people to grow up in. Most people would be the servants of the billionaires in that situation. The one place it would make different, I gave this talk just over 2 weeks ago in Guernsey. And they're really, really worried in Guernsey. Because if that happens, why on earth would you bother hiding yourself in Guernsey if you could be in London? So they've kind of worked out whatever happens, they're in trouble. Sovereignty, for most people, sovereignty is not an issue. For most people, politics is not an issue. They really don't care about politics. They just go, oh no, not another election. Most people care about their family and friends not being ill, being able to house yourself, not having worry, not being stressed, being respected at work, those kind of things. Most people really are not bothered about the idea of whether our 650 MPs are in charge, or whether part of a commission is in charge of what kind of plug you can have to go into a cassette player. You know, as long as somebody sorts it out so there's some rules, that's okay. But you're right, we'll have to follow one set of rules or the other. Who would be stupid enough to invent their own plug which is different from everybody else's? Ours is actually used in Cyprus and Malta. Bless them.
A huge thank you again to Chris and Daniel for a fantastic talk on Brexit, and hopefully demystifying some of what we've been reading. So, a huge thank you.